how about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. He's John Littlefoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunch Berry.
No!
No one steals my Crunch Berries.
I think you mean my Crunch Berries. Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, 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 click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Last time, Seth Robinson and I discussed the metaverse and NFTs. This time, we expand out to Web3 and the return to work, and we don't quite see eye to eye on one of them. This is a bonus episode of the Business of Tech. Let's pivot, though, because NFTs are built on Web3, right? Another area where I think both of us as analysts have been sort of struggling to say, like, well, what do I have to say about Web3? Seth, what do you, how are you classifying it? What are you talking about with Web3?
So yeah, Web3 is, we're zooming out from NFTs. Like, I think there's some people that maybe kind of hope that NFTs would be the killer app for Web3. And I think a lot of what we just discussed about NFTs probably applies to Web3. So Web3 is the general concept that you're going to use this kind of protocol layer of crypto. Where I'm using crypto, talking about the technology, not talking about cryptocurrency, you're using that kind of as a protocol layer to build everything else on top of, right? And Web3 obviously borrows off of the concept that we had a Web 2.0. The shift from Web 1 to Web 2.0, which has been documented quite a bit, was a shift from who was creating the content, right? It used to be only kind of created by organizations that had the resources to kind of play around on the internet. The shift to Web 2 was social media, and everyone everywhere was able to create content. I think the goal for the shift to Web 2 to Web 3 is not so much about who's creating it as it is about who's owning it, and trying to make sure that that ownership is handled correctly. And again, I think that the technology layer is interesting, and I think it provides some of those tools. But I don't know how much it solves some of the problems. With a lot of the Web3 applications that I've looked at, they're kind of saying, oh, here's the new technology, and it's better than the previous technology, which is true. But that's where the comparison stops. And it doesn't say, here's how we're going to solve the problem of buy-in, or here's how we're going to solve the problem of a lot of people actually caring about this thing. And all of those problems begin to be real world problems that I don't know that can be solved with technology. Now, again, I think the technology layer is the better layer, but we've built an awful lot of stuff on the previous technology layer. And so it's not like you can just swap these things out, you know, in the way that you would, you know, stand up a new server overnight or something. It's a huge undertaking. And a lot of the goals of Web3 sound very noble, and one of them is decentralization. Well, if you go back to 1995 and you read a lot of stuff that was written about the original internet, a lot of people thought that it was going to be decentralized because it wasn't really owned by anyone, but all of the, it's very complex. And so all of these middlemen come in and you need structure around it, and it's not accessible to the everyday person. And so in order to democratize it, you need these layers of control. And I feel like the same thing is going to happen in Web3. I feel like they're trying to solve problems they see, but they're not exactly acknowledging why those problems exist. And they just think that the technology layer is going to fix it.
Yeah, Web3 for me feels like the early internet days, actually. I was describing it recently to someone where, you know, because I actually did a crypto transaction recently to buy like my name on the ENS, you know, on the ENS thread. And it felt like the old days where I had to launch like Trumpet Windsock on my Windows 3.1 machine, and I had to run this, bolt this piece on and run this other bit. And if I made the two work together, then maybe I could actually do something. It has that feel from a technology perspective of like, oh, all the pieces are there. This only took off when it became simplified and made easy for everyone to use. But I think the other thing you've put on is that there's practical technology here, but I'm not convinced that we're not just trading one set of middlemen for another. There's a lot of VCs out there that are looking to, that love the Web3 stuff and somehow are also the people that seem to be benefiting by an immediate shift to technologies that aren't quite there. I love the idea of smart contracts. I like the idea of immutable records. I like the idea of ledgers that we can actually examine. I love these ideas, but I'm not sure the ideas have entered the point where they are useful. And I also think that I'm incredibly skeptical of the people that are pushing it at the level that they are, because I think it is more just about changing the middleman versus true decentralization. And that bothers me in terms of the way this could go. And that is not the point of the technology, but it can be positioned in a way where that's the way it's turning out into the market.
And I think sometimes you're not even going to trade middlemen. It's just going to be the same middlemen, right? Like I said before, these people and these institutions that are providing some of these, you know, middle services, they're not unaware of what's happening out there, right? You know, just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. government put out an executive order to look at cryptocurrencies and to understand these things. The Federal Reserve is not going to be overthrown, I don't think, by people minting coins, you know, on a blockchain. I think there is something real there. There is something practical, but I don't know that it's going to overtake. It's going to come up alongside, right? We've seen cryptocurrencies getting used for very real world problems, but I don't know that it's going to displace.
Well, and there's a lot of reason why we don't necessarily want certain things to be displaced. I quipped earlier that money isn't broken, right? Like the idea of money is not a broken thing. By the way, the war in Ukraine is showing us the power of centralized banking on a geopolitical scale. That's called, you know, that's why we're using sanctions in the way we are, is controlling the flow of money. There are very real reasons to have controls around money. We have figured this out over thousands and thousands of years. That's not a bad thing. It's not a broken system necessarily. Are there bits of the system that should work faster? Absolutely. Do we have problems with money transfers? Do we have problems with interoperability across borders? Yes, we absolutely have those problems, but they aren't fundamental flaws in the banking system. They are, we need to have better technology implementation and move at the speed that we are capable of moving at now versus completely blowing up thousands of years of testing around money. And I'm just using money and crypto as the one example. There's more to Web3, of course, but I'm less convinced that we need to blow everything up and more instead technology enable things that we've done.
Yeah, the one thing that actually is not exactly broken, but it's never been solved, that I think is a common thread through everything that we've talked about so far is identity. I think that digital identity is something that's never really existed. We don't have it in the metaverse. So if you go to your bank, you have one username and password. If you go to somewhere else, you've got another username and password. You are a different person to each of these entities rather than being Dave Sobel or Seth Robinson. I think that the technology that's underlying Web3 and NFTs is potentially something that can help solve identity in the digital space or identity in the metaverse, if you will. So I think that will be a very interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. Like in terms of, I want someone to be working on the interesting idea of solving digital identity. I actually will go back to back in 2008, 2009, as Facebook was coming up, and I actually said they had the opportunity to do a version of digital identity. I still think Microsoft had a shot of doing digital identity. They never did. They never took it on. A lot of interesting opportunities open up and a lot of problems get solved by addressing identity as a thing. But I'm going to throw the last one out to you, and I'm going to let you do one of my favorites because I think it's useful, and I want to get your take on it. Is this idea of return to work and the change of the work environment? I've been maintaining that I think of the things we're debating today, this is one that is actually useful. I offer that I think most people's idea of hybrid work or return to work is not what I'm talking about. I'm not debating this idea of, well, now we're going 3 days in the office versus five. I make the argument that return to work should be a re-engineering of work as a concept for knowledge workers as we can move to asynchronous and we can move to work from anywhere, meaning empowering workers. Hey, what's your take on this whole return to work movement and what's going on around that?
Yeah, I think of all the things we've discussed, this may be the one where we're the furthest apart. Not that we are completely far apart on it, but I do think that we've got slightly different opinions on this one. And I do feel like on this one, it's worth throwing out a caveat here that we are starting to talk about with return to work, we're starting to talk more about human psychology than we are just technology, right? Neither right. one of us necessarily has a background in those things, but just like everyone else, we can play one on Twitter. So that's what we're going to do here, right? Is be kind of armchair psychologists on this thing. And my position for most of the past 2 years, I think is kind of similar to your position on money, right? That like, there actually may be some things broken about work, but I'm not sure that they are broken enough to need to re-engineer the system. And I feel like I've seen that play out a lot. So we can see a lot of data points where it talks about how much people want to go back to work. But I write surveys, I field surveys, and I know how difficult it is to capture nuance in a survey. So I can send out a survey that would say, how many days a week do you want to go back into the office? And someone might say two, three, whatever. What I can't do as much in the survey is say, how many days a week do you want to go back into the office given your current financial situation, given your career aspirations, given what you're trying to do with your life? At that point, the person might say, I'm going back in every day because I want the FaceTime, right? Or I can't switch jobs or whatever it might be. And when I see the data points that get thrown out in headlines and news stories, that's one red flag that I feel is going up for me, that they're talking a lot about what workers prefer to do. And I can't help but think that, yeah, a lot of IBM's workers in the 60s probably did not prefer to wear a blue suit and tie. IBM didn't care. IBM was like, this is what we're doing, right? This is what we believe is the most professional way of doing things. Now, over time, that changed. But it wasn't mostly because of worker preference, I don't think. I think worker preference came in, and as the rest of the world changed, then the companies could change, right? So I don't know how much companies are going to be looking at worker preference and saying, you know, all of our workers want this thing. I think they're going to be looking at things like turnover. And so I think the quick rebuttal to turnover would be like, oh, well, we've got the great resignation. Well, but it's not resignation. People are resigning from one job just to get another one. They're moving around to try to improve a financial situation. I don't even know if they're moving around so much to get better remote situation or flexibility or whatever it is. Maybe there's some of that in there, again, among knowledge workers, because you've got a huge part of the economy that really none of this is even available to.
It's the control that I think is the interesting bit. And I don't want to cut you off. Because it's less about worker preference and more about worker control. I think what we're seeing is, particularly as competitive as the labor market is and has been steadily getting more competitive in the knowledge worker space, it's about we've kind of reached a tipping point of allowing worker independent control. And it's almost an extension of the gig economy mentality, where if everyone is their own entrepreneur and everyone is in charge, we've been telling everyone that they are on their own, right? Particularly in knowledge workers, we don't have as many unions. Each individual worker is in charge of their own negotiation, in charge of their own benefits. Well, what we've also figured out is that also means there comes a tipping point when you need the labor and it's really scarce that they get a level of control. And we just did a 2-year experiment that said, well, the old rules that were in place aren't necessarily required to get to the outcomes that business wants. So thus, there are areas where we can question certain rules and say, well, I don't think this whole debate over do you want to be in the office 2 days or 3 days or 4 days, I don't think it's the right question. I think the right question is how much control do you want over that versus how much is imposed by management? And as an extension of that, oftentimes bad management. Like it is a very easy, lazy management practice to say, well, all my people are in the office. I can manage them by visual inspection. You know, in a knowledge worker environment, that's not actually true. All of those that have been doing performative work, i.e. go to the office and look busy, have been exposed as somewhat of frauds versus actual productive workers who can deliver in a knowledge economy. And they have said, hey, I like this. I am showing my mettle. I get control over my entirety of life. I want more of that back.
It will take some time to figure out where the dust is going to settle on this. I don't think we are yet at a point where everyone feels comfortable just doing whatever they would want to do. So I don't know that everyone feels comfortable going back into an office environment, even if they might want to pop in there, you know, 1 or 2 days a week. I don't know that they're there yet. So I don't know that we've got apples to apples from, you know, pre-pandemic to post-pandemic. I don't know that we're there yet. And as much as you talk about wanting to shift from like time-based to task-based, which I completely agree with. And I think that there's a lot of that that's needed out there in terms of managing differently. I think there will also be some realities of individual situations that are going to change over time, where they're going to realize that maybe some kind of a in-person aspect is needed, right? So what I'm imagining is a situation where, you know, an employee comes in and he's like, hey, why didn't I get the promotion this year? And the manager would say, they wouldn't say it's not because you're here. They would say something along the lines of, well, enough people aren't aware of what you do, right? And so that employee then has two choices. They can do a lot of work to make sure that everyone in the organization is aware of what they're doing remotely, which can work. I've seen that happen. It's definitely a thing. Or they can get into the office and have some FaceTime and like meet with people and get some of those water cooler conversations and a lot of those things that aren't necessarily needed for like the day-to-day getting the job done. Like this person is still getting the job done. They're not getting fired. They're employed. But are they, you know, doing that layer of stuff that needs to be happening to get them to the next level? And I think that's what businesses in general are grappling with. And I think that's what the workforce is going to grapple with. But like, yes, we can keep operations going, but can we be innovative? Can we, you know, be as collaborative as we want to be? Maybe. And maybe we need to kind of figure out the technology that would let us get there. Or maybe some of these things will come through a little bit more face-to-face interaction than people might originally be thinking that they want.
You know, I think you've actually said it in a way that we can say, like, I think the opportunity is for smart businesses to actually take some of that visibility work off the people and onto the org. And I think that's where I think this is why I'm excited about this space. And I think there's opportunity. I'm not saying it's easy, but everyone would do it if it was easy. Yeah. That you can build an organization, particularly if you're a business leader, an owner, a manager, you can build an organization that removes some of that work you just described that the employee has to do and put it onto the org. That's the embrace of asynchronous, or the way that work is measured, the way KPIs are put together. And I think the space for innovation is smart leaders designing systems that remove some of that obligation from the worker, put it on the org so that you're not having to do that hustle to show that you're delivering by either coming in or doing the remote work. And instead, the org recognizes productivity and thus rewards it without the cultural biases. It's hard, but that's where I keep circling that area and go, people that get good at that, I think will excel and will have incredible opportunity for recruiting and hiring, and they will get some of the best people because the people are offloaded from the garbage. They don't have to spend all this time justifying or countering the guy that looks busy in the cubicle four down rows down the road who keeps getting promoted, who just looks busy, right? And that's why I think there's an opportunity here is good orgs will do that.
Yeah, and I think that's the trick, right? That will kind of decide things one way or another on the two things that you and I are arguing about, right? Like, will enough organizations do that to create a flywheel effect and eventually lead to a tipping point where it's like, this is the way it has to be done? Like, to go back to my IBM example, eventually enough organizations did not necessarily need to see the suit and tie, and IBM could kind of say, okay, we don't have to do this anymore. It wasn't a decision that they made in a silo. It was kind of the entire economy, world, society moving to one place. And I agree with you. I think that opportunity is there. I think there's a lot of bad management, lazy management out there. And people can, and many people probably will take the opportunity to try to, you know, improve it. Will that be enough to start attracting some of these workers that are shifting all over the place and start, like I said, create that flywheel to where eventually everyone's going to be trying to do it this way?
Right. And you've said it in a nice way, and I'll sort of try and wrap us up by saying, I think at an individual business level, the opportunity is absolutely there to innovate and be that organization that attracts workers. So if I'm advising a particular small business owner or manager or leader, I would say, oh yeah, there's an opportunity right now when the labor's tight, there's an opportunity to be great at this. I am willing to bet that enough will figure this out, that we will get to a tipping point, and I'll layer on the sort of cultural acknowledgement of there's a lot of workers out there that have just spent 2 years that are going to go, yeah, you kind of been lying to me for a while that it is required to be in the office. We've proven that's not true. What else are you lying to me about? Mm-hmm. Like, I think there's just a destabilization where bad managers, orgs are going to get enough pushback that there's space for the innovators. So I'm willing to bet on this happening. Do I think it's happening in the next 3 weeks? No. Do I think it's going to happen reasonably quickly? I actually kind of do. And I always caveat by going, analysts like me always think it happens faster than it does. But I think this one feels real. And I'll give you a chance to sort of say, like, so what's your take on kind of the time frame, if it's going to happen at all?
I haven't thought too much about a time frame other than I think my gut has always been longer than people think, right? Like, I think people expected, you know, this 2-year pandemic thing to flip a switch, right? And be like, oh, you know, companies are going to figure it out. Business travel is going to stop, you know, all these things. And what do we see? You know, we see a lot of companies who maybe haven't figured it out. A lot of companies who maybe understand the space very well, but they are still trying to achieve a certain thing. They might have good management, right? But they still believe that the best way to their success is by sticking with the operations that they have. You know, I think we've seen business travel coming back because people want to see each other. They want to get on the road. It's not necessarily because it affects the bottom line in a short-term window, but it affects these relationships long-term, right? So again, I still don't think we're completely out of the woods in terms of everyone feeling completely comfortable to travel or go into a packed office or whatever it is. So I think we have to get to that space and then start seeing what are people really choosing with their personal preference? How are they exercising some of the control that you've talked about, and how are organizations responding? So I could see us, you know, continuing to watch this for the next 2-3 years easy.
Well, Seth, this has been super fun. If people can respond to us, if they've got topics, they maybe we'll do this again. If there's a bunch of topics that people want us to talk about, how can people find you if they're interested in some of the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so a lot of our research is available at comptia.org. We run a podcast called Volley every other week. And then on the off weeks on the YouTube channel, we have a shorter video called Trend Watch, where we're going over just individual topics really quickly. So those are some of the easiest places to find us and dig into the research.
Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSP Radio. Or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit mspradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.